You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 6, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ari Paul, New York City-based journalist. He's covered the issue of police in his most recent piece in The Jacobin, Smashing the Lynch Mob. Also on the program today, Huffington Post, Washington Bureau Chief Ryan Grimm. On, well, I guess looking forward to 2015 in the House. Scalise, Boehner, Antonio Weiss, TPP. Also on the program today, speaking of TPP, the battle over fast track begins to heat up, both on the left and the right. Also on the program today, the CIA Inspector General decides to spend more time with his family after the whole, brouhaha over the CIA spying on the Senate goes nowhere. Meanwhile, Chris Christie, not simultaneously, makes an ass of himself on national television, which apparently is more important to people than the fact that he's really just incredibly corrupt. But we will talk about both on today's program. And Robert McCullough, the DA, who presided over, or I guess set up is more accurate to say, the Ferguson grand jury, sued by a grand juror who wants to be able to speak of her experience. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. And a reminder, as we go into 2015, folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. It's somebody who reviewed the program on iTunes, and they were upset that I, once or twice a show, make a plea for members. They felt somehow like I didn't put in the time to warrant it, or I'm not sure. It was a very weird review.
What?
Yes. It was a little bit annoying.
I was drunk.
And well, Michael, I would say to you... that's the case. You don't have to listen. Oh, wait a second.
I don't. I'm already one beat ahead of you. I see where you're going.
As soon as I said that and I was looking at you, I realized, oh, my God. Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Also, give us a rating and a review on iTunes. Subscribe through iTunes. It pushes us up on the ratings. It gets us a little bit more attention, gets more people listening to the program. Of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's justcoffee.coop because it's a co-op. It's employee owned. And of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll start with Ari Paul, and then later in the program, Ryan Grimm. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ari Paul, a New York City-based journalist whose most recent piece in The Jacobin, Smash the Lynch Mob, of course, speaks to the labor movement should be rallying against police violence, whether police unions like it or not. Ari, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's start. First off, there was a report in the New York Times yesterday that the number of arrests, the number of criminal summons, the number of parking tickets and traffic tickets have dropped precipitously year over year. Parking and traffic tickets down by 90%. Summons also down by close to 90%. There were half as many arrests made in the first 7 days of this year as there were, or 6 days of this year as last year. So, it's clear there's a labor action taking place.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But let me characterize it for us. It's not let me rephrase that. How much is this about De Blasio's saying that his son had to watch out, or he had to give a speech to his son about watching out for cops? And how much has it to do with the politics of the union and the politics of the city?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk that this comes back to the statement that Bill de Blasio made about how he warns his biracial son, Dante, to take special care with the police, and that's been trotted out a lot. But I think there's been a lot of deep-seated tension. I mean, from day one, I think Bill de Blasio, during his time both as in city council and as public advocate, had always angered the police unions and police advocates because of, most recently with his with his campaign promise to reform the stop and frisk. He was always aligned with people who were, tended to be critical of the police, people like John Liu, or people like Letitia James, who's now public advocate. So I think there was always some trepidation about him coming in, and there had Leonard Levitt, who writes the column NYPD Confidential, had noted that the police unions, there had been some mumblings that they were upset over the settlement in the Central Park Five case, his closeness to the Reverend Al Sharpton. So this was all sort of like simmering underneath the surface here, and that when the non-indictment came out and the statement came about what he told his son Dante, that was kind of the moment that everyone grasped on. But it had been brewing for a while.
You know, I mean, explain to us how this concept of it, and I think people who listen to this program have some basic knowledge of the Central Park Five case. We had Ken Burns on some time ago to talk about his documentary. It was five guys who were basically teenagers at the time. This took place 20 years ago now, I guess it is. And between the five of them, they served anywhere from, I think, 7 to 12 years in prison. They were basically coerced into confessing to this crime. It's quite clear they didn't do it now. It was quite clear 10 years ago. And they finally got a settlement from the city. It was $40 million. I mean, we're talking about, you know, just to put it in perception, 10% of the parking fees that the city collects in any given year, which is less than, I think, one one-hundredth of the city budget. Yet the police department harbors a resentment that they got paid out. I mean, how does that work? What is going on institutionally with the police?
I think they feel that, you know, all the, you know, everything that happened with the Central Park 5 case or any instances of excess that happened, especially during the Giuliani years, you know, sort of, you know, in the wake of the 70s and 80s, what's often referred to as the bad old days, is that these things happen in a context of them fighting the worst of New York City crime and that they're being blamed for being aggressive when aggressive, you know, measures were needed. For example, you often see in Bill de Blasio, both Bill de Blasio and his police commissioner Bill Bratton said this as recently as yesterday, that they're sticking to the broken windows theory of policing, the idea of policing small crimes before they become big crimes, because this is what, you know, transitioned us from bad old days to, you know, the glory days of less crime and, you know, rents going up and more, you know, gentrification happening throughout the city. But it's somewhat disingenuous to take those sentiments and put them here. I mean, the Bronx is not burning right now. We don't have massive crime in the streets. And if there was that, there would be a little bit more, well, I think a lot more, embrace of aggressive police tactics. But we have, you know, rents are going up, cities are, all the boroughs are becoming more gentrified. So I don't think there is the feeling that we need to hold on to this practice that for a lot of people made sense in the 70s and 80s, or in the wake of the 70s and 80s, but doesn't make a lot of sense now.
And so when we talk about so you had this general animosity towards de Blasio that predated all of what has taken place with Eric Garner and the movements across the country. What else, I guess, in terms of the political dynamics are at play here?
Well, the other thing is that Pat Lynch, the head of the Police Officers Union, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, is up for election in this spring. And his union is in a very tough spot. Bill de Blasio, when he came into office, you know, last year, he promised to settle all of the outstanding labor contracts that had been not negotiated during the Bloomberg administration. And in that time, he settled just about most of the major contracts with DC 37, the teachers, and it should be noted the superior officers of both the fire departments and the fire department and the police department. So now the PBA is the only union. The only major union, I should say, that is left without a contract. And according to several reports, they're so far apart in their negotiating that they're headed to arbitration, which means that a third party panel would hand down a decision on what their labor contract could be, and it could be anywhere. It could be the pattern that's been set in the other contracts. It could be below the pattern. And Lynch is obviously very, very tense about that. He, as well, he should be. There's a saying in the labor movement that a president is only as popular as the last contract. So if they're waiting without a contract and a poor contract is handed down, he could be in some trouble. So I think he's trying to be proactive in trying to show that he is out there fighting the forces that are fighting the police department, in part just because of his own political struggle.
You in your piece, you quoted Brooklyn College sociologist Alex Vitale. I think I'm pronouncing his name right. And his point, I think, really struck me as well, that if Lynch, it's one thing for Lynch to go out and say this, it's another thing for him to think that this is what's going to help him to say this type of the rhetoric that he's been involved with. And because it reflects upon who he thinks is going to be voting for him and what's going to attract him. I mean, this is, you know, this is, I guess, our version of Steve Scalise saying, like, I'm just like David Duke without the baggage on some level.
Right.
It makes you wonder who his constituents are. And it makes me a lot more nervous about the police department. But does anybody have a sense, really, of what the dynamic is amongst the police? I mean, because it seems to me that this police force probably on the ground is very different than the one that was that was around even 25, 22 years ago when they rioted more or less on the Brooklyn Bridge against Dinkins, the Dinkins administration. And, you know, we hear all these reports of people turning their backs, but it's 100 or so or hundreds versus thousands of police who were at these funerals.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, the fact is that the NYPD is different from what it was 25, 30 years ago. It's much more diverse. There are many more blacks and Latinos, women in the ranks than there were. I mean, it's sort of, we sort of have this collective memory of it being basically Irish people from, you know, Staten Island. I mean, that is still a big element of the NYPD, but it has dramatically changed, and that should be appreciated. I do think that the PBA, police unions in general, this has been noted by a lot of the black law enforcement advocacy groups, that even though departments like the NYPD have diversified, the police unions as a political force tend to still reflect that kind of, for lack of a better way to put it, kind of an Archie Bunker, get off of my lawn political sentiment that is, I mean, it's still in the city, but it's waning in its influence, especially as the cities gentrify. And, you know, you look at a person like Bill de Blasio, who represents the antithesis of that political tendency, was elected with overwhelming support.
And that, you write, is also enhancing, I guess, the number of people who have sort of jumped into this debate. He's become, well, you write that he is, he's creating a lot of concern on the right in general. And that's why on some level this story has become, I mean, obviously it's New York, and it also ties in what was taking place in Ferguson, what was taking place across the country in terms of African-American males in particular getting shot, frankly, by police. But that this aspect of it has taken on a national tenor because de Blasio represents something to the conservative movement that they're concerned about.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I mean, the Eric Garner case is a national, international news story on its own. But I think there was always trepidation on the right about Bill de Blasio's ascendancy. I mean, on the one hand, he's a local figure, but he's the mayor of the largest city in the United States and is thus a national player. And he represents kind of the sort of Elizabeth Warren getting back to economic inequality, to talk of any economic inequality, talking about progressive taxation, that this is sort of a return to liberalism's roots, when as opposed to Clinton liberalism or something like that. And so the right had been very tense about him being successful, that if his policies were to work, there would be more people like him in the Democratic Party rising in the ranks. And when he was running, there was always this talk of, well, if you elect Bill de Blasio, liberalism is going to bring in, the bad old days of the 70s and 80s. So crime is something that the right has always tried to focus on with him. And it's something that Bill de Blasio has always been very, he's been nervous about. If crime spikes, it's going to hurt him very, very badly, which is why I think he brought someone like Bill Bratton from the Giuliani administration to come and sort of assuage those fears. But that's why you're sort of seeing Rudy Giuliani, the Manhattan Institute, Fox News, the New York Press join forces, ironically, with a powerful public sector union. I mean, it's sort of, you would think that they wouldn't want the power of public sector unions to dictate, to hover over City Hall, but that's exactly what they're doing. And and that hypocrisy, I think, exposes how desperate they are in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating on both ends of it, isn't it? I mean, on one hand, if de Blasio gets through his term with a continued reduction in crime, or even a plateau in the reduction of crime, all of Giuliani's magic, right? Because we've ended stop and frisk after all these years, more or less, I should say. You know, it's down to about 10% of what it was in terms of sheer numbers. Suddenly, America's mayor doesn't look like he was such a magician. Maybe people start paying attention to the lead theory, as it were. But But have, and I want to get to the part about the police unions as a public unit, because it seems to me that police unions and to a certain extent firefighter unions as well are always treated differently by the right. I mean, I'm thinking in particular what happened in Wisconsin, but because of that dynamic, because they have to project we're strong on crime and these are, you know, these are all heroes in uniform.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that there is a conservative ideology about the role of the state, that it's play, that it should play this very, very minor role, and that it basically the state should just ensure public safety via police and fire departments, and everything else should be left to the market. So it is actually somewhat consistent with their theory of how the state should operate. Privatize everything else, but public safety is the only thing that the state should be in charge of. So there's that, but also it is a little racial. I mean, what they're kind of saying when they say, oh, we want to privatize or downsize clerical workers or school lunch workers, that end of the workforce, we're mostly talking about lower income professions that attract many more people of color than, say, the police and fire departments. So they'll never come out and say that, but I think that that's an element that should not be ignored.
And so what do you think happens here? I mean, de Blasio came out with a pretty strong, I don't want to say shaming of those police officers who protested, but it was a pretty strong statement, relatively speaking, I guess. Does that indicate that de Blasio feels like he's on the other side of this?
I don't think he's on the other side. I think he has tremendous leverage now. I think the police union and the actions of them turning their back to the funerals has really left a sour taste in the public's mouth, and I think he knows that. The question is what does he do with that? Bill de Blasio is not characteristically a fighter. He is someone who negotiates. He tries to bring parties together, and he's fairly open about that. So I think this is actually a moment for people who are calling for reform in the police department to really seize the moment. You've seen a lot of protests in the street. With the Black Lives Matter hashtag has generated a lot of attention. But this is sort of the time in which I think they can really push for some sort of change, whether it's a reduction in the police department budget, whether it's a change in tactics, and really, moving away from broken windows policing. And I think they should seize on that time now, especially because it's hot now, but also because the New York City budget negotiations start this spring. It's pretty strategic.
And this has national relevance, of course, because much of what comes out of New York in terms of policing philosophy or, I guess, practices will spread to the rest of the country.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency among New Yorkers to see themselves at the center of the world, and sometimes that can be a bit of a bad thing. But the truth of the matter is New York City really is watched for these types of things. If New York can lead the way on this, it can happen in Chicago, it can happen in L.A. and Philly and Ferguson. I mean, the real fact of the matter is we need to be talking about these issues in the places other than the big cities. The big cities tend to catch our attention, but really, unless you were from Missouri, you probably hadn't heard of Ferguson, Missouri until this year, and we need to start talking about that more.
Ari Paul, the piece is in Jacobin, Smash Lynch Mob. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. I don't know how quick it'll be. It'll be quick enough. And we're going to talk to Ryan Grimm, who just has a story out about it's just so much kabuki, what's going on with John Boehner's challenge from the right. But my argument would be that much of what we're going to see over the next 12 months from the Republican-dominated Congress is going to be kabuki. I wonder if actually they're engaging in Japanese classes right now at Berlitz. All right, let's take a quick break when we come back. Ryan Grimm. I know, things will get funnier in 2015 than they start off. We're a little rusty. All right, we'll be right back. All right. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program, ladies and gentlemen, the Washington Bureau Chief. Do I have that right? Of the Huffington Post.
You got it.
Ryan Grimm. Hello, Ryan.
Nailed it.
I nailed it.
How you doing?
Good. How are you doing? Happy 2015.
Good. And a happy one to you.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Now, 2015, of course, ushers in the 114th Congress. I assume you're aware of that.
They're coming.
Being the Washington Bureau Chief of Huffington Post. Now, there's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. I guess we should start with Speaker John Boehner. He is supposedly getting a challenge from Louie Gohmert and also from Ted Yoho of Florida. Now, we all know Louie Gohmert. He is the congressman from Texas who some of us here think may be a deep, deep cover agent for the Soviet Union. I'm not sure if you're aware that he was he studied over there in college. But be that as it may, Ted Yoho of Florida is also challenging. You've just got a piece coming out that just came out 30 minutes ago. We're pointing out why this is a little bit of a theater by Ted Yoho.
Yes. So on October 20th, which is not that long ago, down in Florida, Ted Yoho was a co-host of a fundraiser for the Boehner for Speaker Committee, which was raising $10,000. For $10,000 a pop, you could swing a club in the vicinity of John Boehner. For smaller amounts of money, you could go to a party and get your picture taken with him, which no doubt Yoho did. In other words, he fundraised against himself just about a month or two ago.
All right. So knowing that he literally fundraised for Boehner to be speaker.
And what I love is it's not just that he fundraised for Boehner. It's the actual Boehner for Speaker Committee.
Exactly. And so here's now maybe Ted loves to play golf or whatnot. But I mean, what's going on here? I mean, there's two dynamics that seem to be in play. One is that statistically speaking, you would have to have people who voted for Boehner in 2012 to be majority leader, to be their majority leader, a year after he had done so poorly, actually, in terms of getting Republicans reelected. This time, now that they've taken over the House, they would have to vote against him based upon the numbers. Even if all the new members who come in, a Republican, voted against him. And then, on the other hand, you have a full court press by the right wing machine, Cottage Industries, Talk Radio, World Net Daily, whatever, Breitbart, to unseat him. So what's happening? Is Ted Yoho, is he just preening?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, he's one of the, he's one of the kind of insurgent Tea Party guys in public. You know, when it comes to, like we were just talking about, when it comes to fundraising for Boehner and for the party, you know, he's a team player. But this is an opportunity for him to capture, some of that energy that you're talking about. You know, the Breitbart and the talk radio energy out there that pins all of the blame for everything that's gone wrong that isn't on Obama is on Boehner. This is a way for him to, take away some of the spotlight from Louie Gohmert, who seems to
get too much of it, as far as some of these folks are concerned.
Well, do you think that Boehner says to Yoho, like, yeah, go ahead and run. That way Gohmert doesn't get too much behind him, and it sort of diffuses the anger, et cetera, et cetera?
Not exactly. I think Boehner is at a place with cancer gone. There are no serious alternatives to him. There's nobody that has any base from the right that could challenge him. So Boehner's posture is more to ignore folks like Yoho and Gohmert than to kind of sit down with them and talk about ways to satisfy Breitbart. Boehner does get a little bit of the light out of annoying some of the more obnoxious talk radio folks. So he in some sense doesn't actually want to tamp it down all the time.
Now, I don't want to embarrass you, but you got a little bit out hustled. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. Breitbart has an exclusive with your buddy Sean Hannity, who apparently exclusively to Breitbart.com reiterated that he's not backing down and thinks Speaker Boehner should be fired.
I don't know how they got that. You can't win them. You can't win them all.
Yeah.
Well, the vote is happening any minute now. But Sean's taking a courageous stand, I guess.
Yes. Well, I mean, you should get on that. Maybe you can get the exclusive when Sean Hannity is pissed that the vote didn't go his way.
I do like how Breitbart puts it, all caps exclusive, in front of every single story that they run.
Well, he did apparently email Breitbart. I don't know if he just emailed. I don't know if it was like a newsletter or if he just emailed them specifically. But
like pitches at Breitbart.com or whatever.
Exactly. Tips at Breitbart.com.
Yes, yes.
So Sean and these guys, of course, this gives them some room. I mean, they're immediately have to be on the. The Republican control of the House and the Senate is not Republican enough. But give us a sense of like what's happening with Scalise. In a different day, Steve Scalise would probably be shamed out of his post. But it doesn't sound like he's going anywhere. I mean, this is a guy who once said that he's like David Duke without the baggage. I don't know if virulent racism you would refer to as baggage. I think it's just more like he's known as a virulent racist.
Right. That's not the baggage. That's the traveler.
Right. Exactly. I mean, so what's going on with that? I mean, no, the Republicans don't feel like this is a liability for them at all.
You know, I like to think that I'm pretty good at predicting how things are going to play out in Congress. And when this was unfolding, I was pretty sure that Scalise would have to step down over this. And it looks like I miscalculated that calling yourself David Duke without the baggage, going to a some white supremacist conference, and then 2 years later voting, being one of the only people in the Louisiana House to vote against Martin Luther King Day, all of those things coming out together is not enough to knock him out of leadership. You know, this is a post-autopsy world. Remember, they did there after 2012 when they got annihilated by the multicultural coalition that put Obama in. You know, they did this autopsy and said, well, we need to be more sensitive to the concerns of the African American community, which you might think would include, having somebody like Scalise step down after something like this happens.
You may be assuming that all African Americans have a problem with white supremacist groups, and that may not be fair.
Well, Mia Love is standing by him.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, you know, I wonder if. this isn't, I mean, because I have a theory about, and I also, I want to talk about Antonio Weiss, which is sort of a different, but it's, it, you know, and it, you may be just tied up in your liberal racism and your, you know, your liberal intolerance to not be able to embrace someone who's a white supremacist. But I wonder if this isn't indicative of are finally sort of crossing some threshold where this battle where that would actually, I guess, generate that autopsy that we saw in 2012 is over. In other words, you know, the first thing that the House and the Senate is going to pass, and I do think they're going to pass this, is Keystone XL. I don't even think TransCanada wants to do Keystone XL anymore, based upon what's going on. I'm serious about the oil prices.
Yeah, no, you might be right.
And I think President Obama is going to veto this, and that's not something I would have said 6 to 8 months ago. I think he's just going to do it immediately. And then where do the Republicans go? Like, they have – I mean, I can't – it seems to me that literally – the only thing that they have left is just basically passing stuff for their base, which they, on one hand, are afraid of doing because they don't want to be seen as being obstructionist. But it seems like it's the only thing they can do.
Well, also going from opposition to governing is proving to be difficult for them. Just look at this proposal around the 40-hour work week. You know, I don't know how close you follow this, but you know, in Obamacare defines a full-time worker as 30 hours. And so anybody that works 30 or more ought to have health insurance provided by the employer. Now, the Republicans have hated this provision and have accused it of pushing people's hours underneath 30. You know, and so they, you know, anybody who doesn't work enough, they'll say, well, that's because of Obamacare. That's what's doing that to you. And the policy's not great. You know, it should probably be phased in, you know, so that if you work 20 hours, they pay, you know, 2/3 of it or whatever.
But
that's neither here nor there. Their proposal is to bump it up to 40 hours. But now all of a sudden, there are conservative intellectuals telling them, hey, actually, guys, if you do this, there are millions of people that currently work 40 hours a week, and their boss could very easily bump them down to 39, where it's not easy for the boss to bump them from 40 down to 29.
Right.
So the problem that you're trying to solve, you're actually going to make worse. And so you have people like Yuval Levine and Bill Kristol urging Republicans not to do this top priority thing that they've been saying they're going to do the whole time, because, you know, in opposition, it sounds great to stand up for the 40-hour work week. But when you then, when you look like, oh, well, what will be the consequences of us doing this? Now, on the other hand, it appears as though even after it's been pointed out to them that it will backfire, they may still go forward. And why would that be? Because they actually are not concerned about the hours that a worker gets. They just don't want the employer to have to pay for the health insurance. You know, they're very strongly opposed to the employer mandate. That's no secret, and that's the real motivation. But the employer mandate is actually an extremely popular provision of Obamacare. Everybody thinks that bosses should cover health insurance.
Well, that's my point to a certain extent, is that the only things that they have to pass, and I think many of them will be vetoed. It doesn't, you know. Even like this time last year or midsummer, like the idea was they're going to make Obama veto some very popular bills that they want. But they don't seem to even have any. They've run out of them. Right. I mean, like literally, I think all that's left of them is to make a statutory sort of like permanent committee on Benghazi, like at this point. That they don't have anything that they can push. And by the time they get into the fall, they're going to be – it's over for them, because Ted Cruz is always going to be saying no to whatever it is the Republicans are going to do, or he's going to be saying that's not enough and I'm going to vote against it on principle.
Yeah. Yeah. And between now and then, probably their best friend will be Obama's veto pen, because that kind of gets them off the hook for the consequences of ill thought out legislation that they might pass. I like this 40-hour work week thing. So let's say they actually do go ahead. You know, I think a lot of the leadership would actually be secretly hoping that Obama vetoes it. And then they can continue to kind of operate in the opposition posture, which has never hurt them. You know, they didn't do any governing in 2009 or 2010, and they were rewarded with, you know, a wave, and they took control of the House, and they didn't do any governing over the last 4 years, and now they control Congress. So there's no real incentive for them to
set up
some type of governing infrastructure.
I mean, I think the problem is that there's a massive drag on them that even if they all gathered in a room and said, this is what we want to do, they couldn't possibly do it. There's nothing they could implement at this point that wouldn't piss off their base. I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that on some level, like, I have a sense that the critical mass has been reached. And, you know, just like, you know, in 2012, where the so-called establishment candidate, even though he pulled himself way to the right during the primaries, I mean, it may be fatally so, I think, to a certain extent. I don't even think that guy wins this time around. I mean, I think, like, they have basically given up on those aspirations on some level and now just need to hold on to their jobs by, you know, the cut. There is not a sense I get in the country that people are screaming for that reform on the 30 hour mandate. You know what I mean? That mm-hmm. just doesn't have the sexiness. The one thing that I want to do, I do want to talk about that I do think that is possible, and I want to get your sense as to how much this is heating up, is fast track. Because 2 days ago, Phyllis Schlafly, to the extent that she's still actually writing her own stuff, wrote in WorldNet Daily that, you know, was quoting Elizabeth Warren about giving. Uh-huh. And this is the one thing that I think the president and John Boehner want to get done, which is fast track authority.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be interesting to see if that can happen, because certainly by the fall, Ted Cruz blows it up. In the spring, I don't think he's there yet.
Right. You know, yeah. Our guy Zach Carter actually interviewed Schlafly for a piece he did on trade. You know, she's still kicking, and she's fighting hard. And the Tea Party is very engaged on this. And the liberal Democrats in the Senate and in the House are organized. The liberal grassroots groups don't have a whole lot to fight over, so they'll be energized. So there will be, some energy around opposition to it. Lindsey Graham, has been very skeptical of it, and he's a key player on this issue. So, Boehner and Obama clearly want it badly, but. It's going to be a real fight for them, and you're right. The clock is ticking on them.
That's going to be interesting. And the other thing I want to touch on too is the Antonio Weiss fight. Tell us who Antonio Weiss is, and what's happening around him.
So he's a guy who his career has been in mergers and acquisitions. He's been setting up big global buyouts for 20 years or so for a private equity firm. And he's been tapped to be the number three guy at the Treasury, which would oversee the implementation of Wall Street reform and handle the portfolio of debt that the Treasury has. And Elizabeth Warren and a bunch of other Democrats have made him kind of a symbol of enough is enough to, enough with the Wall Street. Everybody from Wall Street running down to Treasury. And one reason they've kind of hit on this guy is that he actually has no qualifications for this particular position. You know, it's usually the people from Wall Street who accuse the lefties of being without nuance. But in this case, the argument is, which is quite compelling, is that he has never traded a book in his life. you know, he's never been a traitor, and now you want to give him a $15 or $16 trillion book of debt. He's never been a regulator, never had any experience with regulation, and now you want him to oversee Obamacare and the Andrew Ross Sorkin, I mean, Wall Street reform. You know, Andrew Ross Sorkins of the world say he, you know, he's a smart guy from Wall Street. And to them, that's enough.
Right.
You know that, that you work in that zip code. And he also is a publisher of Paris Review, which buys him all sorts of dinner party points. But you're seeing an increasing number of moderate Democrats in the Senate coming out and saying no to this guy. So, you know, Warren has really kind of, laid down the gauntlet here that this is a hill she wants to die on. So, you know, it'll be, I think she has a good chance of winning.
And if she does win this fight, I mean, it just seems to me that every time something like this goes her way, it increases her authority, I guess, in the Senate.
Yeah, that's right. And it also sends a signal that things are changing slightly. And that's actually one thing that Sorkin has said, that, you know, if you do this, nobody from Wall Street's going to want to, you know, come work in Washington, as if that's a huge threat. You know, because there's this worldview that, you know, the only and most talented people on the planet, you know, all work in finance and in New York, and the government would be unable to operate if it, you know, if people couldn't come from New York and work in the government for a few years. And actually, we didn't touch on the grossest part of it, which is that he has a clause in his contract, which a lot of Wall Streeters have, that if he leaves to go do government service, his options all immediately vest. And so he would get a $20 million payout that he otherwise wouldn't have gotten in order to go work for the government, which you don't have to think about that for long to get how obscene that is.
Well, it's obvious. It's the Wall Street firms really want to promote civil service. They really
yes.
feel strongly about giving back to the community.
You know, one person who works in the industry described it to me as a recruiting tool. They said it's almost never used. But when they're out trying to recruit these very smart college graduates and grad students who don't want to think of themselves as masters of the universe and Wall Street creatures, they tell them, well, look, you know, we have had X number of people in the past go into public service, and you know, they serve the country, and then they return to us, and here are the incentives we have to encourage people into public service. So actually, when they do the recruiting, they do sell it as a very noble possibility. Now, the person said that, you know, in practice, once these people you know, talk themselves into becoming bankers, they stay bankers.
Right.
There are a lot of Wall Street people in Washington, but most Wall Street people stay on Wall Street. So that's kind of the genesis of that provision. But when you do actually trigger it, it's a windfall.
Yeah,
he could buy a couple more literary magazines.
I imagine. So when will we know? And of course, the other aspect of this, when Aaron Ross Sorkin says that if you do this, you won't get any more Wall Streeters who will go into public service, is not just that you're shutting out, you're cutting yourself off from the best and the brightest in the country, but it's also the most sensitive. Because the idea that, like, if you don't confirm every person who's willing to go up in front of Congress and take a $20 million buyout to go into public service, you're offending all of us.
It is, you know, I think it gets it gets to how guilty I think they feel about what it is that they're doing, how insecure they are about it. You know, you like poke in the most gentle way at one of these titans of finance, and they just explode, right, like 3-year-olds. It's truly remarkable. You know, the president, for example, has done everything he could think of to make life wonderful for people on Wall Street the last 6 years, but because in one interview, one time, he referred to them as fat cats, you know, they despise the guy. I think it has something to do with their inner psychology. I can't quite get my head around it. You live closer to them. Maybe you have more insight, but it is quite remarkable how.
Well, fat cat is a really mean term. I'm not sure if you've. I mean, and I would also use as an example the attempt by the Democrats to use wealth inequality as an electioneering slogan, which died out in March of last year or so, or April, presumably because some of the those fat cats were like, hey, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, that lasted like a week.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's fascinating stuff. And I guess when will we know? Like, when will this whole Antonio Weiss thing be resolved one way or another?
My understanding is that the White House's strategy is to, at this point, is to kind of drag it out, hoping that they can slow down the opposition because they have no momentum of their own.
Right.
And then they can get him into meetings with enough senators, and he can kind of charm them, and you know, he can talk about civil
Paris
rights,
Review,
and gay marriage, and the Paris Review, and you know reproductive freedom, and all of the things that you know he agrees with liberals on, and say, oh, this is a nice guy.
Here's the question. Does he lose the $20 million? In other words, when does his stock options vest? Does he actually need to get confirmed, or is it enough for him to be floated as a nominee to get the $20 million? Because, you know, if he's going to lose the immediacy, he's not going to lose the $20 million. He's not going to be able to get it immediately. Then I'm going to have a lot of sympathy for the guy.
That's an excellent question.
And I'm being facetious.
There might be layoffs at the Paris Review coming.
That's right. Well, that there you go. Ryan Grimm, once again, I've helped you out. You get scooped by Breitbart on the whole Hannity thing. But now you know the central question. Will Antonio Weiss get his $20 million even if he is rejected?
We'll go find it out.
By the Senate.
We'll track it down for you.
Ryan, thank you so much.
You got it.
All right. We'll talk to you later. All right,
later,
folks. Look at that. One day, well, 2 days in to 2015, we're already giving, what is it, 15 minutes out of 40? That's like what? That's like 20% more free show already. Unbelievable. Gosh. All right, folks, going to take a break, head into the funner half of the program. You know the deal. We rely on you to keep doing this show every day.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Too much?
Too much. I've had enough of this, selling of the show.
All right. Matt just walked out, so I'm going to have to hum the music into the funner half. All right, folks, give us a review and a rating on iTunes, or is that too much to ask for that guy? All right, we'll be back. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM on your instant message clientels. Clients, clientsers, client, clienting, clients.
Client, yes.
And or you can just do it through the app, which you can get for free, majorityapp.com. As the music starts 4 seconds ago, 10 seconds ago. MajorityApp.com.
Waiting for you to hum it.
MajorityApp.com. It's a free app, iOS or Android. Allows you to listen to the show, podcast the show, download the podcast on the show. Search our archives, our complete archives, if you remember. Just the last 50 shows. We've done now over, 1,000 done it over 1,025 shows. One of the things we're thinking about is just actually numbering the episodes instead of dating them, because many of our interviews are timely, or not timely, timeless. I don't know. If you have thoughts on that, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Hopefully we're going to get our crap together and do an Indiegogo campaign sometime soon. But Michael's been too busy updating his Facebook page, so. Michael's too busy crafting his LinkedIn profile.
Booking tickets.
Booking tickets?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Michael's jet-setting around now. Oh, my God. All right. We'll be right back.